Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Rounders, a history of baseball in America. I'm excited to be with you today as we have three guests from the SoCal Vintage Baseball League. They're here to talk about what they do in terms of running a vintage baseball league and talk to us a little bit about the differences between what you can expect to see in a game back in the late 1800s to now. So I'd like to welcome Chris, who is here on behalf of the Riverside Smudge Pots. And we have Wes, who is the commissioner and captain of the Crestline Highlanders. Welcome, Wes. And then we have Travis, who is here as captain of the Palmdale Blue Stockings. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
So, you know, I honestly didn't realize that there were active leagues out there that practice vintage baseball rules. My story in terms of coming across you guys was I found Chris's Instagram page for the Smudge Pots and started looking through some posts and thought, oh, this is neat, and then learned a little bit more about it. And, you know, I was fascinated to find out by doing some more Instagram research and internet research in general that there are vintage baseball leagues all the way across the U.S. And it's neat to see that this is a really widespread thing. And I guess my only claim to knowing about vintage baseball games is I grew up right outside of Clinton, Massachusetts, and they have their claim to fame. That town is they have Fuller Field, which is at least according to the Guinness World Book of Records, is the oldest continually operating ballpark in the world. And wow. So every July they would do a vintage baseball game where community members would come and they would play by vintage rules and they would have outfits to wear, but it would be more of a pickup style type of thing. So this is very exciting for me to learn more about this. And I just want to thank you guys for coming on the show. And I'd like to go ahead and jump right into some of the questions that not only I have, but I'm sure other listeners have as well about this. So guys, if I were to show up to one of your games and I'm unfamiliar with vintage baseball rules, what would be some of the main differences between a vintage baseball game and watching a regular modern day Major League Baseball game?
This is Wes. And the first thing that you would notice would be the uniforms. Uniforms are 19th century uniforms. Something almost like you would see an Eight Men Out maybe in a movie like that, or Field of Dreams, but even a little bit older than that. So that would be one of the first things you would notice. When it goes to rules, you have seven balls to a walk, and you still have the three strikes. You'll notice that batters will not wear helmets or batting gloves or sunglasses. The players are not identified by numbers or names on the back of their jerseys. It's just mainly you represent a town or a city. You'll see a umpire that's referred to as a sir, who will have a top hat. He'd be dressed maybe in a tie, suspenders, kind of dressed like he just got off of work, maybe as a judge or some kind of public authority or something. You'll be calling the balls and strikes and the outs, and you might see him wearing or smoking a cigar while he's doing this.
Okay.
Also, this is Chris from the Riverside Smudge Pots. Also, one of the main things is the equipment that you'll see, or the lack thereof. The catchers do not have shin guards. The players out on the field, or the ballist as we call them, they're wearing like basically a garden glove, for lack of better words, as far as the equipment's concerned. So that's one thing that kind of sticks out.
And Chris,
I was going to say this is Travis, with the Blue Stockings. The reason that the umpire is dressed differently and dressed so officially is because going back to that time period, the umpire was usually a clergy member who was above reproach, who everyone trusted their judgment and their fairness. So the umpire was not to be questioned by anybody in the stands or on the field, and his ruling was final. So there was a formality to his dress that you wouldn't see nowadays.
So you wouldn't have the manager coming out and kicking dirt on home plate, I guess, huh? Yeah. So With the rules that you just mentioned, with especially trying to keep the historical aspect to the game, do you have official rules set where if a guy decides to show up from one of the teams with sunglasses on, that's a no-no right off the bat?
Right. We are addressing our umpires to make sure to let the players know when they don't have to, when they can't wear sunglasses or eye black. And we, and our captains also are aware of the rules, so they're keeping their teams in order.
And what's the size of a team that you, how many guys per team do you field usually?
Well, we have to have the usual nine on the field. Okay. But we try to keep our roster, about 15, 12 to 15.
Okay, very good. And Chris, going back to what you mentioned, you said that, you know, there's certainly a lack of equipment compared to today's players. For all of you guys, what's some of the most difficult differences in playing vintage versus modern baseball?
I would say definitely the glove. Yeah. So everything, even if you grew up playing baseball, you know the game, you feel like you're somewhat, you know, decent of a player. Once you get out there with the glove, it's just getting used to catching a ball without any padding. That's difficult, and just like kind of slowing down the game so that you're not gunning a ball at someone at first base and they have that limited equipment. So that's been my biggest challenge. And I think I would say most of the players on my team, I think it's the glove.
Now, Chris, could you walk us through for people who haven't seen a glove used in a vintage baseball league? What are we talking about here? Is it like basically a glorified leather glove? What does it look like?
Yeah, it's like a glorified, like isotoner little leather glove that, you know, kind of fits snugly on the hand. There is a newer model with a little bit of padding, but most guys use the one with almost absolutely nothing on it. And then the catcher's glove has a little bit more padding, but definitely nothing that you would imagine in today's day and age. So when you bend over for a ball, when you're used to having about 4 inches touch the, you know, the ground, you just don't have that. So trying to backhand and everything is a lot more difficult.
Now, and on top of that, there's no webbing between the fingers.
Yeah, no webbing either. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, is that the same for the catcher as well, or has the catcher's mitt evolved differently up until this point with vintage rules?
Well, the glove, this is Wes, the glove that we were using, they were using up in the Bay Area, which they have another league, was a little bit less padded, no web, and so we kind of bend the rules a little bit, and a lot of purists will not like to hear this, but we bend the rules a little bit because we stepped it up to a 1915 glove, which has more padding, still no webbing. We take out the web, and the reason being is because a lot of guys were actually breaking fingers, and they got to work the next day, so it was pretty good.
Yeah, that's another. This is Chris from the Smudge Pods. That's another thing we've discussed as far as rules. Is that most, you know, all these guys got to go to work on Monday morning. I have a guy, you know, it's like a computer programmer. I know that sounds like some demonry right there, computers. But that's how he makes his money, and you know, takes care of his family is with this, you know, programming. And you break your, you know, break your hand or finger out there, or you collision at the plate. That's something that, you know, Wes has been very mindful of when he kind of came up the rules for the league. So
yeah, you can't lose the money makers. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Since we're on the topic of equipment, guys, what do you do behind the plate on offense? What do you do for bats? Does that look the same as a modern day baseball bat?
This is Travis. The bat, a modern day bat, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is between 32 and 35 ounces. The vintage bats that we use, they're special made by one of the ballists in the Bay Area, and it's a minimum of 40 ounces. And what we use on the Blue Stockings, it's 35 inches long, and it's completely solid. It's never going to break, and it's about 42 and a half ounces. So you're out there swinging a pretty good piece of lumber.
So you guys have, you must have all gym memberships for all team members, I'm assuming? My goodness, that's a heavy, heavy piece of wood.
Yeah.
Well, we had a new guy come out to practice yesterday for the first time, and he picked up the bat, and he said, well, that doesn't feel that much different, doesn't feel too heavy. And we said, okay, stand there and take a few swings. And after about his 10th or 12th swing, he looked like he was getting pretty tired. He said, this is a lot more difficult than it looked like at first.
Wow. And what do you notice in terms of the players that play on these teams, especially when they first start, like you mentioned, do you have a high ratio of ground balls with using these types of bats? Do you get a lot of homers? What's the average, you know, hit cycle like for someone using this equipment?
Well, it also comes down to the ball. The ball is made differently. It's the old dead ball. So at the beginning of a game, it feels hard like a modern ball. But as we play with one ball for the entire game, whether it's hit out of the park or whether it gets dirty or wet, it becomes a little bit mushy, a little bit soft. So by the end of the game, the ball doesn't fly off the bat nearly as hard as it does at the beginning of the game. So you're going to see a lot more, you know, fly balls in the end of a game than you will towards the end.
Travis, can you talk a little bit about, for our listeners who are unfamiliar, what's that ball made out of during this time, the ones you play with?
That's actually a Wes question.
Oh, Wes. Passing it off.
I'm not exactly sure what it's made out of, but it's definitely not like your modern ball. Like Travis was saying, it's a little bit softer. It has the same type of stitching. The only thing is it gets softer and softer. And we play with one ball the whole game. I mean, that's what you typically try to gun for, you know. Nowadays with how fields are made, we may lose a ball and have to replace it, but we typically try to stick to the same ball the whole entire game, which makes it a lot very difficult to throw if it gets wet or muddy or whatever, you know. So I'm not sure exactly what it's made out of. I mean, we have someone who's in charge of that. So I don't know what to tell you.
I believe it's similar.
I believe it's a cork center with twine or string. It's just wrapped by hand instead of by machine, so it's a little looser in there.
It's not wound as tight.
So you're dealing with a ball that essentially gets heavier as the game goes on and softer, so that presents a whole new difficulty for players as the game goes on then.
Yes, definitely. Wow.
So, you know, we along the same line, talking about difficulties, guys, talk to me about the uniforms. Are you wearing straight wool out there in the Southern California sun, or what is it with the uniforms?
Well, Palmdale, for those who don't know, it's an hour north of Los Angeles, and we're in the middle of the Mojave Desert, where they film scenes for pretty much every movie that's ever set in the desert, all the Westerns, you know, and there's a Mad Max festival that happens out here every year just for, you know, for that kind of thing. So it tends to be in the triple digits in the summer. We get to 112, 115 on a regular basis. And yes, our uniforms are made out of wool. Wow. So that's going to be as we're going here into our first season, that's going to be a bit of an issue. We did design them to have lace-up fronts instead of button-up fronts, so we can kind of loosen those if we need to. And we did cheat a little bit and have a slight cotton wool blend to make it breathe a little bit more. But they are heavy and thick, yes.
Well, I can't blame you guys for cutting some corners, triple digits and wool. I can't imagine that. Well, more power to you. In terms of
against Crestline.
Say one more time.
Trust? That's our secret weapon against Crestline.
Oh, good factor in there. I like that. Very good. So actually, I'm going to save that question for later. I wanted to talk to you guys about what your travels like in terms of, you know, visiting and going back and forth. But are there any other, I guess, major difficulties in terms of differences where, you know, kids playing regular Little League today just would not understand if they went and watched one of you guys in terms of what you deal with?
Well, like one thing this is Chris from the Smudge Pots. We played an exhibition game against Wes's team, the Highlanders. And one thing I don't think we are ready for, being that they've played a few games already, was the quick pitch. So the minute that the pitcher or the hurler gets the ball back into kind of like the circle and in front of the mound, they're able to pitch at will. So there's no getting out of the box, taking a few swings or anything like that. Once the hurler gets the ball, they're able to throw it back. So we had a guy on our team strike out literally. It took about like 10 seconds and he looked at three pitches. Wow. He was subsequently given the nickname the looker, which is kind of stuck. So he's kind of owned that. And yeah, so that was one thing that I was like, whoa. And I think that really kind of messed up our pace of the game. But I think kids wouldn't get that one.
Interesting. So
that being said,
it is very much a hitter's game because of the high count that you can get with seven balls. So our scores tend to look more like football scores. The one game that we played against the Highlanders, they beat us 28-3, you know, which that won't happen again, but it is definitely very much a hitter's game, even with that fast pitching.
Now, would you credit the high scoring games, the normal nature of that, to the lack of defensive tools, like, you know, a better glove, or is it the speed of the ball coming off the bat? What would be the main reason for those high scores?
All of the above.
Okay.
Yeah, there's not one play. This is Wes. There's not one play that's routine anymore in this game. So you got to run everything out, and just never know, because the ball and the equipment is just limited, and you know, you just the games could get a high score on there. So
interesting. So guys, talk to me a little bit about the roots of baseball in Southern California. When did baseball start there? What's the background story to the birth of baseball around there?
Well, that's something where I this is Wes. This is something I'm still kind of researching. When it comes to Southern California, there is a limited, as far as I've seen, it's just not documented as well as maybe Northern California. Northern California has a rich history right now. Southern California is just, we're trying to discover, you know, whatever we can. We're looking through, you know, I've come across some newspaper clippings of maybe something that says a club from here played a club from there. And that's all the information you get. Mm-hmm. There's not very much as of right now. We're still digging. But I'm hoping to come across a lot more. Maybe, you know, talking to some more people in who have to do with history, historians, or, you know, going to look public libraries and looking through newspaper clippings. And so it's just something that's ongoing right now. It's pretty new to us. It's pretty new to everyone out here, I think, when you're talking about 19th century.
Well, maybe I can help you guys out. I can dedicate an episode to this, but yeah.
But this is Travis. I was going to say that one thing we do know is that there were a number of teams in the Southern California area, the most prominent of which was the original Los Angeles Angels, who played in the late 1800s, and their big rival was the Hollywood Stars. And so if we get a new team starting up either in Los Angeles or Hollywood, that name should be available.
Very good. You know, I'd like to go through and ask each of you about your respective towns and team names, because, you know, it's always interesting to see the birth of you know, an actual name based on geographically where they are. So Wes, I'd like to start with you. You are the captain of the Crestline Highlanders. Do you have any background information on the origin of that name?
Well, I live in the San Bernardino Mountains in Southern California, so I'm way up about 5,000 to 6,000 feet.
Oh.
And right now, I do have some friends that are historians up here in the mountain, and there is no accounts of anyone really playing baseball up here at any time. I'm sure there maybe might have been a stick, some kind of form of a game going, but nothing maybe organized at all. So I live in Crestline, and it's a small town. When you read about the vintage about baseball years ago, it was like a town, you know, town versus town type of thing going. So small town area. So this is kind of that feeling. I wanted to keep. Although Crestline's not the original name of this town, it went back to Houston Flats. It's called Crestline now, and I kind of wanted to just base it off of that because the community needs something to rally around, and a lot of them are just unfamiliar with some of the old terms of this town, and it wasn't really looked as a town that. That was going to be established where people were going to live. It was just being used for they were just setting up camps here, and they were building Lake Arrowhead and these different other towns that they felt like were going to be more prominent. And then eventually it settled and became Crestline. But the Highlanders, the name I chose was I was trying to do research on to see what was the oldest. There was a lumbering industry. So I was trying to figure what would sound right or what if I can go back as far as I could. And the only thing I came across really is that this the Serrano Indians used to live up here during the summers, and during the winter they would go down the hill, down the mountain. But a lot of the Spaniards that were in the area down in San Bernardino areas, which is the city below, would call the Serrano Indians the Highlanders. That was like their nickname, oh, the Highlanders. So I just thought, you know, they've been around forever, just to pay heritage to them. I said, you know, we should be called the Highlanders. So Crestline Highlanders, that's how it came about. And another little thing, and this isn't something I chose or really meant to do, but we have this joke on the mountain that when people come from the city up the mountain for, you know, when it snows and they want to hang out here, we call them the Flatlanders. That's kind of their nickname. You know, because they don't know what they're doing when they come up here. They're driving on the wrong side of the road and different things. But so you know, it kind of goes with it. They're the Flatlanders. We're up here high, and we're the Highlanders. So there's a couple terms right there for you. But that's how I chose the name. I just decided to give homage to the Native Indians that used to live here.
I like it. That's a neat historical tie. So let's move on to Chris. You know, you were the first account I came across on Instagram with you guys. And my first question when I saw it was, what the bleep is a smudge pop? So can you talk to us a little bit about your team name, the Riverside Smudge Pots? Where did that come from?
So this is something that was kind of hard. Originally I found out through a Facebook post about Wes's team. So I tried to join the Highlanders. I wasn't allowed because I was a Flatlander. but Wes was like, hey, start a team in Riverside. I grew up in the city. I've been involved as a docent at, you know, the Mission Inn Hotel, which is a National Historic Landmark. So I've been in the history of it all. And so the first thing we were going to call our team was the Riverside Citrus, due to the citrus industry that Riverside was known for. And then it just wasn't clicking. It just didn't sound right. And I wanted something a little bit more quirky, a little quirkier. And so a smudge pot is an orchard heater that prevented the orange industry and citrus in general from, you know, all the trees from freezing over during the cold winters. And so Riverside had this huge freeze in the early 1900s, and the smudge pots really came in after that and, you know, prevented that freeze from happening, because Riverside was just had such a burgeoning citrus industry. In 1895, Riverside was the richest city per capita due to the naval oranges. So that's kind of where the smudge pots came in. So we take a smudge pot to every game and we have it out there. And when we win a game, which we didn't do our first time out, we're going to try to, you know, make some smoke come out of the smudge pot.
Well, by the way, the Riverside team, it was an actual team back in 1878.
Okay, so there's
the Club of Riverside.
So Wes made me aware of that. So there are a lot of teams in Southern California that just weren't very, they're a little bit boring when it came to their namesake. So it was like Club of Riverside or Club of like Colton, which is nearby. So Riverside was in existence as a team from 1878 to actually 1909. They had a club. And like Wes said, like there'd be a newspaper article that just said this team played this team or this team practiced on this date. And so there's just not a lot there. I've consulted local historians and they haven't really sent me too much either. But we're definitely on the pursuit of, learning more about the baseball landscape in the late 1800s.
Very good. Yeah. I mean, it seems like at the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, people were more concerned with nicknames for players than they were for teams. I'm not really sure why that is, but regardless, let's ask you, Travis, I'm curious, the Palmdale Blue Stockings, where is the origin on that name?
It's incredibly recent, actually. We were known as the Pilots up until about 3 days before this phone call. Palmdale itself didn't exist in 1886. It was still being founded at that point. It was originally called Palmenthal, which didn't quite sound good on a big jersey. So It's known for its aerospace industry out here. You know, we're pretty much known for two things, which is planes and movies. So neither of which existed in the late 1800s. As I was naming this team, I was trying to come up with just different ideas. I was thinking, you know, the Pioneers, but our local college is already called that. And I tried to come up with just, you know, animal names, but they either just didn't sound right or local high schools had them. I looked through, you know, vintage baseball terminology, aces, hands, you know, things like that. And they were either overused or sound good with Palmdale. So I settled on, you know, even though vintage baseball were a modern team playing 21st century, just in that style. So I said, you know, as a nod to our aerospace, we'll call ourselves Palmdale Pilots. And so we made all the social media and everything for the Pilots. But then it's still just, you know, stuck in my craw and a few other people. And then once we started kind of getting known, you know, we had a little bit of backlash. Not that really changed my mind, but it kind of brought it back up. And so I looked down at my uniform and I said, you know what? We have navy blue socks. We're going to be the Blue Stockings.
Okay.
But after I made that decision, I looked it up and there was a team, the Toledo Blue Stockings, in 1884, they played in the American Association in the major leagues for 1 year. And during that time, they had two African-American players with them, making them technically the first integrated team in majors. So if anyone wants to come at us about this name, I'd refer them to Wikipedia.
Interesting. So there's a good mix of, you know, tying in the history, but also trying to focus on what I think early baseball really tried to do was to build up town pride and recognition.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah. And that's one thing that really got me excited about starting a team in my hometown was just to be, you know, be the first vintage team. There's softball teams that are a dime a dozen. Everyone I know is playing on a softball team or something of that sort. So for Wes to, you know, start everything up and give us the opportunity to bring it to our town and really market it and try to build it from the ground up, it's been exciting.
So that's a great segue into the next question, guys. As you establish these teams in each of your towns, what types of people that you've seen typically come out to participate in playing on these teams? You know, what kind of people are you drawing? Is it college kids? Is it historians? Is it, you know, older people? What's the mix like?
Well, this is Travis. It seems to be a good cross section. I have somebody on my team that just turned 18 to meet the insurance requirements before the first game. And we have someone all the way up into their early to mid 50s, you know, so it's a good cross section of ages. And, you know, different body types, you know, a lot of people could turn something into a double, but I'm barely chugging in the first, you know, so it's just a good, well-rounded look at the different people in our community.
Yeah, this is Wes. Just to chime in on that, I also have seen, like myself, I've played baseball all my life, up until college and adult, you know, adult leagues. So you get guys like me who are playing, guys with a little bit more, maybe more experience. Maybe they went into their college 3-4 years into college playing, and then you have guys who just, you know, they played up to was like little league, and then you got the historian guys that are just all about the vintage stuff, and they just want to put on the uniforms, go out there and have some fun and learn the rules, which is super cool because everybody's almost balanced out because of the equipment. Going back to that, it's like everything has to be relearned because you're doing everything. Your fundamentals are huge in this game. And it's like a lot of times we, like players like myself, have gotten lazy with, you know, like Chris said, 4 or 5 extra inches on my glove and a lighter bat to swing and just those types of forms. So this kind of evens out the playing field with the equipment we have and the different experiences. It just kind of, it balances itself out. And I'm seeing a lot of different types of people wanting to get involved.
So you mentioned that your youngest player is 18. Do you guys know who you're, like, what's the age of your oldest player in the league?
Would that be the notes?
Yeah, I think we have someone who's 55. 55 okay. Is probably oldest.
Gotcha. So
that's on the smudge pots?
Yeah, he could actually catch a ball and outfield, you know, a fly ball better than probably, you know, most of our players. So
yeah, wow. I would say I would say the Crestline Highlanders got maybe a player in his 50s as well.
Okay, that's interesting to see. You've got, like you said, a really good cross section of people joining up. So talk to me a little bit about the fans that come to these games. Is it also a neat cross section? Do you see mostly family members and friends? Is it history buffs that are showing up there? Who comes to see these games usually?
At this point, we haven't had an official season game yet. We've had a couple of small exhibitions. So it has just been friends and family at this point. But as we're going into the inaugural season of the league, we're all about to do a major social media push and see if we can get just people from our communities in. The mayor of Palmdale just recently contacted me and wants to come out and throw the first pitch at our home opener. So, you know, we're going to try and get a little bit of, you know, old media, new media, press, see if maybe we can try and get people just in the community involved.
Very good. That, you know, I wish you guys all the best. That's a great place to be. And, you know, I found you on social media. I found it fascinating. If it wasn't a, you know, a 36-hour car ride, I'd be there to watch a game too.
So. It's probably only 3 by plane though.
That's true. I'll start
you
saving.
Can take up the now. Train. Take the train.
So, and maybe this will help in terms of the growth of the league as you go. I'd like to know, and Wes, you'd probably be the best to answer this. If you have someone who's listening to this who's in Southern California, maybe moving to Southern California, maybe decides to move after hearing this podcast, if they were interested in joining a vintage baseball team, especially yours, where would be a good place to start?
Well, social media, like I said, Instagram, we're on Instagram, SoCal Vintage Baseball. We're also on, we also just started a website, so scvbb.com. And we're also on Twitter now and Facebook. So that's probably the best way to contact us right now is through social media, and try to plug you in on one of these clubs that has a space. And if not, you know, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say this, that I want to have another, I'm already thinking about 2020. I'm already thinking about getting another club going in Southern California. I don't think I'm going to wait for someone to just pop up and say, hey, I want to start a club. I actually think I'm going to go out there and get the ball rolling and recruit guys for the club.
Very good.
Yeah, we need those Hollywood stars back.
Yeah, work on, you know, landing. I'm trying to think of a Hollywood celebrity right now. Yeah, that would be great if you could land someone like that. But, you know, I think just watching those, like I said, that vintage baseball game that happened every year, you'd get 300-400 people showing up to that small field in Clinton to watch this vintage baseball game, because it gets people, I think, in a nostalgic mood to really tie into their roots, and it's fun to watch, and it's good for kids, and it's, you know, it's not, I mean, how much does it cost to go to an MLB game nowadays? This is a good second option for families. I think the potential's there, definitely.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree. A Memorial weekend, we had was it Memorial or Labor Day? Labor Day weekend.
Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, Labor Day weekend. So the Crestline Highlanders, because we had our uniforms and were more established at that point, we got in communication with the Bay Area Vintage Baseball League, which is the Northern League that's been around for 15 years plus, possibly. And we reached out to them, and one of their teams, actually the Oakland Colonels, decided they wanted a barnstorm. They've been wanting a barnstorm, and they came all the way over here to Southern California, and we played them in 2 matches in Crestline on a Saturday and a Sunday, and we got it advertised, and we kind of talked to local media, and we actually, the first game, we had about between 200 to 300 people just show up just to watch that.
Wow.
And the second game was just a little bit less. It was on a Sunday, but it was quite a few people that showed up just even on a Labor Day weekend when everyone had plans. And that actually was really good. And the Crestline team, it's a little easier with the Crestline team because it's a small town to get that, get everyone rallying around it. While the other, you know, like Riverside, Long Beach, and any of the other clubs, it's a little harder because they're in a bigger area, bigger city. There's so much going on. So we want to see those teams also get the backing of their city and their town, and just we want to kind of push, like Travis said, and let people know what's going on.
Well, it definitely takes people who are as excited about it as you guys to grow it. So that leads me into my last question. I'd like to hear from each of you why you decided to get involved in playing vintage baseball. Why do you do what you do? Wes, I'd like to start with you because you're the commissioner. You got this all going. What drove you to get involved with this part of baseball and baseball history?
Well, it was kind of an accident, I guess. a good accident. I played baseball, like I said, all my life, and I was playing in an adult league. I actually ran a team in Southern California that was a pretty good team. We were doing tournaments and winning and stuff, and I ended up moving for work up to from LA to San Jose, which is Northern California, the Bay Area. And when I got up there, I wanted to plug myself into a baseball, adult baseball league, and that's where I came across the Bay Area Vintage Baseball League. And I actually showed up to a game and the first thought I'm a Eight Men Out, like one of my best favorite movies. And so when I saw it, I was like, oh no, it's like Eight Men Out. Like, what am I watching here? This is crazy. And so, when I started talking to the coach on the team, he actually was the, commissioner or founder of the league. And, I told him I'm interested in playing. He got me on his team and I actually played there for a whole year. In 2008 for the San Jose Group. And I knew I was coming back to LA. So when I moved back to LA, I was talking to the commissioner at the time, and he said, hey, there's nothing like it in Southern California. It'd be awesome for you to start something, and maybe we can get something going between the two leagues. And so that's kind of how I got into it. I loved how it looked. I loved the challenge of it with the little glove and the bat. But I really didn't have, I really kept that idea in my back pocket for like 10 years until I actually decided to move forward with the league.
Chris, what about you? What got you involved with vintage baseball?
I would have to just, it all boils down to for the love of the game. Just growing up, always been a baseball fan, but always more concerned with the history of the game. I'm a purist when it comes to that. Stuff about the modern game is kind of, you know, like you said, the price for admission or these contracts that are being dished out. And so just reverting back to more of like a simpler time, evoking those memories of yesteryear for people. I think people are interested in that just to kind of escape from like all the modern society and the pace of it. And like for fans to go out there and also to do it for our city. That was intriguing to me. And also just, I mean, the only opportunities you have to kind of play the game when you get older or playing in a softball league, which, you know, with metal bats and in these leagues where, you know, just people don't respect the game or know the game. And they're just out there just trying to mash a softball over a short fence. That kind of got old. So having this opportunity, I always looked at, you know, these leagues on, you know, Instagram of in the East Coast or down in the South. And for one to be, you know, located in our backyard, it was exciting. And then just kind of reconnecting with friends through the team. And I have a couple coworkers on my team. So it's just kind of a nice little social event to kind of get out of the house and, you know, play America's greatest game, you know.
Travis, what about you? What keeps you coming back to play vintage baseball with these guys?
I had a little bit more of a roundabout way. I like odd things. I like things that are pretty normal, but just slightly out. I like strange sports. You know, I used to play Quidditch. You know, I play all sorts of different things, and I'm also heavily into the steampunk community out here. So you know, there's a lot of crossover of that late 19th century kind of aesthetic. And one day, it was around 4th of July a few years back, I just said, hey, I see all these, you know, Civil War reenactors and World War II reenactors. I wonder if there's anybody that does, you know, vintage baseball. And so I just Googled it up, and it just so happened that right at that point, the Redondo Beach team down here was starting. And this was prior to my having met Wes or anything like that. And I wish he was on this phone call, but Jay also had formerly played in the Bay Area, and he was starting the Redondo Beach Wharf Rats. And so I practiced with them for a year or so, but there was no other team to play against. And then he connected with Wes, who was starting Crestline at the time. So I transferred over and played with Crestline for about a year because, honestly, they were much, much closer to me than Redondo Beach. Crestline's only an hour from Redondo Beach. It's about two if there's no traffic. And so I played with Crestline for a year. And then as we were trying to put together a league, we needed four teams. I said, you know what? Hey, I'll try something in Palmdale. So, yeah, before there's even been an official game, I've already played for three different teams.
So you're the journeyman of the league then, I take it, huh?
That's right.
Well, hey, Travis, on a completely side note, if you're looking for a neat, new, odd sport to check out, I just moved to Miami here in July, and this is an up-and-coming sport that's being revived because it used to be really popular in Miami. It's called High Lie. Have you ever heard of it?
Mm-hmm. No, I haven't.
Oh, so just...
It's kind of like, yeah, where you throw that ball really hard in the... Kind of like a lacrosse net.
Yes, exactly. It's like It's like racquetball, but you use this weird scoop on the end of your hand, and the ball can kill you if it gets in the wrong place.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, check it out. It's fun to watch. Well, guys, I would love to close out by giving you the opportunity to talk about how people can learn more about your respective clubs and how they can connect with you on social media. Wes, I want to start with you again because you mentioned that you have a website now for the league. If you could mention that again and just overall, if people are interested in following the SoCal Vintage Baseball League, how can they do that?
Yeah, so we just started a website. It's just the abbreviation for SoCal Vintage Baseball, scvbb.com. We're also on Instagram as SoCal Vintage Baseball and on Twitter as well, SoCal Vintage Baseball, and on Facebook.
Okay. And Chris, how can people follow you and the Smudge Pots?
Yeah, on Instagram, we are at Riverside Smudge Pots. And then we're also on Facebook. It's just Riverside Smudge Pots. So we try to post, you know, kind of things we're working on, merchandise we're trying to come out with, little buttons, things like that. So trying to do a few posts a week. But you can definitely connect with us. And if you're interested in playing, send me a direct message on our Instagram. We'll be happy to connect with you.
Chris, do you do your own graphic design for your posts on Instagram?
Yeah, we do some of that. I'm not a graphic designer, but my friends and I, we get together and we had somebody design something for us. But yeah, most of the stuff we're making at my house, you know, ironing it on, pressing it. I have a couple button makers here. So yeah, we're just messing around all the time. It's fun. I like that aspect of it. So
your design game is strong on your Instagram page.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate that.
I'm always impressed with the posts that are coming out from your page. So very good. Travis, what about for the Blue Stockings? If people are interested in following your club, how can they do that?
Okay, again, through the SCVBV website, but also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at Palmdale Blues. Also, just let me throw this in here. If anyone wants to play, you know, message us. We're still looking to fill out the roster a little bit. But also, if anybody in Southern California is interested in being an umpire for our league, we're still hiring SIRs at this point. So they can contact either myself or Wes if they're interested in officiating some of these vintage games.
Now, Travis, does that come with free cigars?
No, we'll discuss that. Is that going to the league fees, Wes?
Well, guys, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate having the chance to talk about not only the league, but about, you know, baseball in Southern California and just the vintage baseball movement in general. I appreciate your time. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're interested in following any of these things, I will make sure to add all of the social media connections and websites that were mentioned in the show notes. So, guys, thank you very much. Have a good night.
Huzzah.
Thank you, Huzzah. Jeff.
Has anybody on the call seen the movie Highlander? Way back?
Of course.
Okay, good. So that leads to my next question. Wes, when you guys win a game, do you all like turn to the other team and say there can be only one?
There can only be one.
No.
Yeah, feel free to adopt that. You know, I won't copyright it.
Yeah.